No, no, no. No, I didn't go. You went. Now say it.
You went.
Not you went. I went.
Well, I said you went.
When I say I went, I don't mean I went. I mean you went.
Do you feel all right, Daddy?
What's the difference? Noodles, oodles, poodles, cayoodles. He's crazy. Never did I hear such a craziness in an apartment store.
Neither did I.
Hi-ho all, it isn't Rudy Valley. It's the poet laureate of Allen Dally.
Blow the bugle, toot the trumpet. Here is Falstaff. Where shall I dump it? Those were great days. They were wonderful days.
Reminiscing. I feel you near. Once more, you're my love of yesteryear.
Howdy, folks.
Yes, it is your old friend singing Sam. So let's just settle back and reminisce a bit. What do you say, huh?
The nostalgic nod toward the Atwater Kent. We now present Same Time, Same Station, a chronicle of broadcasting's first half century.
Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear.
Tonight, Alan Reed remembers radio.
Well, the first microphone I remember was on WOR in New York in 1926. I had been with a group called the New Playwrights Theater in Greenwich Village, and we were brought up to compete in a drama contest to WOR against the stock company that they had just established. And it was a very interesting experience, got me interested in radio, to the point where I said, hey, I'd like to work in this area. I was at a summer place called Copake in upper New York State. It was an adult camp. People lived in log cabins, but they had a fantastic social staff at this place. And a fella came up to Copake while I was there as social director, and he told me that he was an executive of the Judson Radio Program Corporation, which in the beginning was the sole production department for what is now CBS. I don't know whether this is known or not. At the outset, when WABC, which was the original station of CBS in New York, started, they rented 2 hours of time from WOR, which was the Bamberger Network, I guess, and their call signals were used during those 2 hours, and all of the production that was made during that time was made by the Judson Radio Program Corporation. They had no dramatic or musical departments of their own at the time. They were developing them then. And there were several big shows on the air. Mostly, the most popular ones were from Bernard McFadden's magazines, Physical Culture, True Detective Mysteries, and True Story. And True Detective Mysteries seemed like one that would be right for me. So, Palazzi told me he was with Judson, and I let him know that I wanted to get into this radio field, so he said, come up and see me. He was a young kid, but about my age, and sounded like he had a very important position. When I got up to Judson, I found out he was an office boy just breaking in, and was. But Herb and I became very fast friends, as you'll see in a little while. He introduced me to a girl by the name of Hazel Arnheim, who was secretary to Charles Skenk, who was the producer of the stories, True Detective Mysteries, True Love Story, and Physical Culture, for the Judson Radio Program Corporation. Hazel told me that they were all cast for that week and that I was too young to play the only role that was open, which was that of the big shot gangster that they were after. And that was that. She said, I'll see later on if I can get you an audition. Well, I went downstairs and figured, so I'm young, so what? They can't tell over the radio whether I'm young or not. So I got on the phone. First, I made sure that Hazel went out to lunch. It was around lunchtime. I saw her leave the building. I got on the phone, and I got through to Charlie Skenk. And I said, hello, Skenk. He says, well, who is this? I said, never mind who this is. I'm coming up and see you in a minute. I understand you got a role open.
and I want the role or you're going for a ride. He says, well, come on up. I went up and I got the job, and that was the way I broke in the radio. And Charlie's Cake and I became good friends. Hazel Arnheim married Roger Bauer, who was a top announcer at WOR in New York in those days. And Herb and I went on, Herb Palese, that is, went on to do a program that we had for 3 years. It was produced through Judson Radio Program Corporation. It was called Henry and George. And it was on for Henry George Cigars, and we were two bellhops, and we had a traveling unit, supposedly. We never left the studio, but we'd visit a different city each night and tell about the city and do little blackouts. And we had a singer and a musical, an orchestral group. Herb was Henry, and I was George, and we had a theme song then. You can all afford a Henry George, so smoke your troubles away. With the smoke rings disappearing, cloudy skies will soon be nearing. I've never forgotten that, and that was 1927 we started that, 28, 29, and 30. Don't forget, as far as early as 1931, they were already experimenting with television. In 1931, and I remember it well because that's how I met my wife. I had probably the first television romance in history. CBS, who I worked mostly for in those days, had a small studio on the 23rd floor of their building that they converted to experimental television. They were in all 54 receiving sets in all of New York City at that time, and they were mostly by executives of CBS and some of the advertising agencies. It was a new medium they were feeling out. At that time, you'd work in front of a scanner, they called it, and it was nothing but a series of light bulbs that came up in an arch like a makeup mirror, you know? And that was the sole lighting it had, and in back of that was the camera. And in order to be seen, if more than one person was there, you had to really squeeze in. And I was doing an ad lib thing. They asked the people who were working on the station to come up and try things out. So Stupnagel and Bud, who were popular comedy stars on the air at the time, and myself, went up there, and we were waiting to go on, and they had a little receiver in the reception room. And a very beautiful girl was singing. She was announced as Miss Finette Walker. We were to follow her. And she had a lovely voice. And finally, she came out, and she had green makeup on her face, which is what they use those days. I found that out after we went inside. They slapped some on us, and brown lips. And this was just for the shots through this. There was very little lighting, you see. And I said, we'll be off in a little while. If you can wait downstairs, I'd like to talk to you, because she had hit my eye. And we went on and poked our heads. We had to squeeze in and told a few wheezes and jokes and then came out and I got the makeup off. And by this time, she had too. And we got to talking downstairs, and I told her what a lovely voice she had, and I invited her out to dinner. And we had dinner at a drugstore counter, incidentally, across from CVS. And 6 months later, we were married, and now it's 39 years and 3 sons and 10 grandchildren later. Been very happy. That was the beginning, and then, of course, CBS and NBC, they were developing program departments, and those of us who had got in early and had experience were able to work in all of the networks. And in the ensuing years, I did as many as 35 programs a week, and it was exciting running from one to another. My name was different then than it is now. My name was Teddy Bergman. And it was mostly associated, as the years went on, I started what they called stooging then and doing straight for practically all of the big comedians who came onto radio.
Bob, I was on Bob Hope's first radio show. Bert Lahr, I was his straight man. Jimmy Durante. With Eddie Cantor, I played Rubinoff. Rubinoff, the orchestra leader and violinist, would never appear on his own. He was scared to talk into the microphone. So I had been working with Eddie in a few parts, and suddenly I put on Russian accent, and I became Rubinoff. And Rubinoff and his violin became a national character, and it was I talking for him all the time. Once, Dave Rubinoff had to go to Pittsburgh, which was his hometown. And that is before he came from Odessa or wherever in Russia he came from as a boy. But he still retained his accent, you see. And Eddie bet him $100 that he'd be able to. It was a big benefit they were doing for the Musicians Union in Pittsburgh. And Rubinoff had accepted. And Eddie bet him $100 that he'd be afraid to talk on the air. Because Rubinoff would get this fantastic vision of millions of people booing him. And this is what he told us. And he was just scared stiff to go on the air. Finally, the night of the thing from Pittsburgh came along. And Rubinoff had $100 at stake, which he'd bet with Eddie. And all he said on the air was, "Had he come for you, only $100. That was it. Then he played his violin. I worked with Al Jolson, everybody. I was the original daddy to Fanny Bryce's baby Snooks.
Now, Snooks, tell me, what do you have to do for homework today?
A composition.
Composition? You have to write a composition on what?
On how I spent the day at home.
Well, let me see what you wrote.
Here, Daddy.
This is a composition on how you spent the day? Why, it's a blank sheet of paper with nothing on it.
Oh, I didn't do nothing all day.
Snooks, why did you spend the whole day doing nothing?
Because I wanted to be a good little girl.
I don't understand that at all. You could be a good little girl and still do something.
No, I can't.
Snooks, you have no pride in your education. I'm ashamed of the way Mother and I have to do your schoolwork for you. Now, we'll start the composition. You dictate, and I'll write.
All right.
Now, how did you spend the day at home?
Must I tell the truth?
Well, of course, nothing but the truth.
All right. I woke up in the morning and had breakfast.
Didn't you wash your face?
No, nope, I saved it from yesterday.
Well, I think you better say you washed.
Well, it ain't the truth.
Pick a day when you did wash.
The teacher wants it from this week.
I'll take that up with you later, Snooks. Now go on with your composition. What did you do after breakfast?
I waited.
You waited for what?
For lunch.
You should tell something about what happened.
All right. Daddy and Mommy was fighting all day.
Now, just a minute. You can't write a thing like that.
Why?
Because you'll give the wrong impression. You'll make people think your parents fight all the time. And you know that Daddy loves Mommy.
Not today, he didn't.
That was a very special case about a new dress your mother bought. Let's continue with the composition. And remember, you can't say Daddy was fighting with Mommy.
All right. Mommy was fighting with Daddy all day.
I won't allow it. You mustn't write a thing like that.
All right. Then you write the composition.
All right. After breakfast, I rode on a nice new horsey Daddy bought me.
What horsey?
Now, Snooks, it's just a make-believe horsey for the composition. Now, after you rode on the horsey, what happened?
Daddy was fighting with Mommy all day.
What?
Yeah, throwing dishes.
Now, you know that's not true. What dishes?
Just make-believe dishes for the composition.
Snooks, I don't want you to mention Daddy or Mommy again in connection with your composition. Do you understand?
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happened after breakfast?
A lady and a man was fighting all day.
I don't want to hear any more about that fight. Just tell me what happened to you.
Huh?
Weren't you sent on some errand? Didn't you do something?
Oh, yeah. Mommy sent me to the grocery store.
Mommy sent you?
Yeah, and I went there.
Sent it and went there? What kind of talk is that? When you're writing a composition, you can't talk like that. You must use your very best English.
All right.
Now dictate it exactly as you want me to write it in the composition in your very best English.
All right. After breakfast, I is went to the grocery.
No, no, you can't say that. Don't you know anything about tense? Is the present tense, was is the past tense.
Oh, I was went to the grocery.
No, no, the correct thing to say is I went to the grocery store.
You didn't, I went.
I know you went, but the right thing to say is I went, understand?
Did we both went?
No, 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 I didn't go, you went. Now say it.
You went.
Not you went, I went.
That's what I said, you went.
When I say I went, I don't mean I went, I mean you went.
Do you feel all right, Daddy?
I feel as well as I can under the circumstances. Now, let's go on with the composition.
All right.
Now, what happened after you returned from the grocery store?
Well, Daddy and Mama...
I told you not to mention that again. Now, this is too much. Snooks, you're a very naughty girl, and you're backward in your schoolwork. There's only one way I can see any hope for you. You'll have to pray to the angels every night to make you a good girl.
I pray to the angels, Daddy.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Did you pray last night?
Mm-hmm. But it's no use.
What do you mean, it's no use?
The angels didn't listen to me.
You prayed to the angels last night, and they didn't listen to you?
Mm-hmm.
How do you know they didn't listen to you?
Because today the school was still open.
We worked on the roof of the Ziegfeld Theater, and in the beginning, when we first started, there was a glass curtain between us and the audience. That's the way they had audiences in those days, so reactions weren't picked up too much on the microphone. I would say that about the second year, Dave Friedman started writing the Baby Snook spots, and we started them there on that program. Then later on, Fanny was doing a program called The Ziegfeld Follies of the Air. And then I believe that was the first time that Baby Snooks became a regular weekly appearance. Fanny Brice was primarily a comedian and worked mostly in the Yiddish dialect, but not always. She was a vaudeville star. She had come up from burlesque and made the Ziegfeld Follies, where she would work in a great many characters in sketches, you see, but always a comedian.
Hold on to Mama's dress, Ada. You shouldn't fall. Irving, stop kicking up the sand. Why can't you be a good boy like Sam? The next time you'll stay home from the beach. Abe, it's a wonder you wouldn't watch the children once in a while. Must I do everything? Oh, you might see. Come, darling. We'll go over there by the boardwalk. I think there will be a breeze. Follow Mama. Ah, here's a dandy place, ain't it? You feel the breeze? Oh, it's a pleasure. Come, darling. Here, sit down. Here's the pails and the shovels. Play. No, darling. The red pail is Sam. Now, what's the difference, the red pail or the blue pail? Give the shovel to Irving. You want the shovel. All right, then give Irving the pail. Go on, dig. Dig a hole and bury your father. Now, what are you talking, Abe? I didn't mean they should bury you like a funeral. I mean they should cover you over with sand. It's a game. Everybody plays like that. What you say, Sadie? You want to go in bathing? You two, Irving? You two, Sam? All right. Go under the boardwalk and put on the bathing suit. Hurry up. Stand behind a post so nobody should look on you. Hey, why don't you go in the water? You know, it wouldn't do you no harm. It's Tuesday. Must you wait for Saturday? Ivy, stop looking on Sadie when she is putting on the bathing suit. Abe, that boy is getting more like you every day. Aye, it's so hot. The only breeze I'm feeling is from the fan. Now, come here, darling. Mama will tie the belt. Come, sweetheart, ma. Come over here. No, darling, it's not too tight. It's not too tight, sweetheart. It's not too tight. You want to lose the pants in the water? Now, go take Sadie's hands. You too, Sam. Now, run to the water. You got a piece of soap with you? Well, use it. Go on. Go, 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 go. Go find it. It's only cold at first, a little. Don't be afraid, Sam. Hold on to the ropes. Look out for the breaker. Hey, look at Sadie. She's the brave one. Ay, 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 ay. She's so cute. She takes to the water like a goose. Don't run there. There is running crab. Go, Sadie, darling. Dunk yourself. Dunk yourself again. Dunk yourself again. Don't forget to come up. Oiving, stop flashing faces. You want to blind up the eyes? Ah, it's such a pleasure to see them in the water. Now, come, that's enough, darling. Come in. Lunch is ready. Come. Eat. Look, eh? They look like different children already. There, you'll have a good appetite now. Oidy, you sit there. Say to darling, you sit here. And Sam, you sit here. We got all kind of sandwiches. We got pastrami, salami, liverwurst, pickles, pernenner, and we got ham. It's no use talking. You can't beat the beach for a good time. Hey, look who's... Lavin. Oh, hello, Mrs. Lavin. How are you? You came down to the beach? Oh, who is it, you? You're alone? Uh-huh. Come over here and have a bite with us. Don't talk foolish, we got plenty. Don't be bashful, I'll catch up a bite with you two sometimes. We'll pair a herring together. Here, help yourself. Wait a minute, I'll help you. Say, what have you been doing with yourself? You got so thin, I hardly knew you. What? Oh, you're on a diet. You don't eat nothing but lamb chops and grapefruit? Well, it certainly agrees with you. You know, Miss Pinkus is doing the same thing. One day she didn't eat for 2 days. You wouldn't believe it, but she lost 15 pounds around the holidays. Mrs. Levine, I hear that you... for the Benjamin Arms. I don't blame you. The food there is terrible. Every mouthful is poison. And besides, they give you such small portions. You know, we were there last week. You know to who? To Mrs. Pizzicat's golden wedding. It was beautiful. And what presents. Mrs. Abrams bought a bowl of goldfish. Mrs. Ginsboy brought a box of gold dust. And we brought along the gold boys. Look at my Abe. He's sleeping. You've got to excuse him. You know, he ain't slept good for nights. Not since that holdup in the store. What? You didn't hear about this pickup? Well, let me tell you. Last Tuesday night, Abe was in the delicatessen. Then in comes a man, and he asks for a herring. So Abe goes under the counter, you know, in the bell for a herring. And when he comes up, there stands the man with a pistol. He says, your money or your life? Can you beat it? What did my Abe do? What could he do? The thief had a pistol, and Abe had a herring. It was a very peculiar situation. Irving, darling, look at me, sweetheart. Now, your lips is blue. You got a chill. Take off the bathing suit. Go on, everybody takes off the bathing suit. Hurry up. Did you see that, Mrs. Lavin? He absolutely had a chill. The lips are going like that. Mrs. Lavin, look at that lifesaver. Ay, 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 ay. Ain't he got a beautiful physique? What, you going? Well, goodbye, Mrs. Lavin. I was very glad to see you. Call me up sometime. Ah, I'm in the book. Goodbye. Hey, did you see the way she ate? Like after sickness. Hey, did you hear that? Why, a storm is coming. Come, say they put on the head. Let me put on the shoe. Don't stand like that. Hurry up. Mama's got the pails in the shovel. Hey, why don't you help me? You stand there like an ox and you wouldn't do nothing. Come, darling, don't stand there like that. You want to get me excited? You'll be lightning. Come, see that. Aha, here's the... Come, sweetheart, you sit there. Go sit down there now. Come on, Abe, get the fare ready. You see the conductor is coming? What? I'll have to pay for the little girl. Why, she's only 5 years old.
5 years old? Why, she looks much older.
Can I help with if she worries?
Fanny started singing numbers in vaudeville. I'll never forget, she had one number on the Floridora Sextet, which had been six girls, most of whom married millionaires from this Floridora Sextet. It was a big Broadway show. And she came out on the stage pushing a baby carriage, and she was pregnant again, obviously, and she sang, I was a Floridora baby with a chance to win the best. I had to fall in love with A.B., a drummer with a fancy vest. Now the other girls are living fancy. My address is 17 Delancey. 5 darn fools got married for money. I got married for love. You can see I'm no singer. She was great in that. The serious singing came about because of her marriage to Nicky Arnheim, and he was sent to jail, and My Man was written for her because the headlines in the paper knew that Fanny Bryce's man was there, and that's how that song came about, and it made her, added to her stature as a singer.
He takes me in his arms, the world is bright. What's the difference if I say I'll go away when I know I'll come back on my knees someday? For whatever my man is, I am here forever.
Incidentally, Barbara Streisand, who I may have seen Fanny in movies, but I don't think she was around while Fanny was alive, was so much like Fanny, it was amazing. I sat through that picture saying, my gosh, this girl is incredible.
Baby's Irish Rose.
What are you laughing at?
What am I laughing? I'm just laughing. What's the matter? There's a law against that.
Yes, here it is, folks. Dreen, America's largest selling shampoo, once again brings you that lovable, laughable show, Ann Nichols, AB's Irish Roll.
Amy's Irish Rose had been the play that stumped the New York critics when it opened as a play. Ann Nichols was the creator of it. And it had a basic ingredient. It depicted the problems that would arise between an intermarriage of an Irish Catholic family and a Jewish family. And it was basically a very sound premise, and it had never been attempted on the stage. And very frankly, the early writing on Ann Nichols' thing, the critics had a right to jump on because it was poorly done. And yet, it became the biggest hit the theater had ever known up to that time. It had the longest run. And it played all over the country, and besides, I think it ran for 8 years on Broadway in New York. And it was finally beaten by Tobacco Road after a while. Anyway, it was sold to radio. And Ann Nichols and an associate began casting the show, and I won the very coveted part of Solomon Levy, who was the father of Abe Levy. Solomon Levy was a father with an accent. He was an honest man. He was a hard-working man. And he tried to be real. I tried to make him like a person, like, as a matter of fact, my grandfather might have sounded.
Oh, miss.
Yes. Yes.
We are calling on Mr. Flanagan and Mr. Rosenberg.
Have you an appointment?
Well, not exactly.
Then I'm afraid you can't see anybody.
Listen here, my good woman. This is Solomon Levy of the Solomon Levy Department Store in the Bronx.
It wouldn't make any difference if he was Marco Polo. You have to have an appointment.
Marcus Polo couldn't make an appointment. He's dead.
So is this store.
You're not wrong, brother.
But this is an emergency.
If it is an emergency, as you say, it is quite within the realm of possibility that I can make an appointment for you by the end of the week.
The end of the week will be too late. Right away, we've got to see it. Yeah, wait just a second, please. Young woman, maybe you didn't hurt my friend. I am Solomon Levy of the Solomon Levy Department Store in the Bronx.
Well, when you write, be sure and use your business letterhead.
But,
sometimes people write in for appointments and don't use the letterhead.
Mm-hmm.
We have strict instructions to ignore all such correspondence. People who have legitimate business always have proper forms on which to communicate. That's what our Mr. Rudolph
Rose always says. Now, one time...
Stop it! Stop it! I'm losing my mind. Now then...
I'm losing mine, too. And it's all the fault of your Mr. Noodles.
The name is Roodles.
That's the difference. Noodles, Roodles, Poodles, Cayoodles. He's crazy. Never did I hear such a craziness in a department store.
Neither did I. Now then, will you go in and tell Flanagan and Rosenberg that Murphy and Levy are here to see them? Or do I have to break the door down?
If you use that unseemly tone of voice to me, I shall be compelled to call our new general manager, Mr. Abraham Levy.
No. Wait, don't do that.
Sir, my instructions are very explicit.
What?
I have been instructed to call on our Mr. Levy whenever I have a problem with which I cannot cope.
Oh, listen, girlie. Cut out the highfalutin gab. How do you like it?
What do you think?
Just what you think.
Now we're giving somewhere.
What's your name?
Susan Jones.
Well, Susie, what would happen if we told you we had an appointment?
Well, if the records showed a bona fide appointment, I would usher you into their presence.
And, what if they didn't?
I would immediately check for a mistake. If the mistake was located, I would apologize to you.
You have to talk this way to everybody.
And how?
Don't you ever get tired making all these explanations?
That, sir, is my position. I tire? Certainly. But as Mr. Roodles says...
Again with the Roodles.
Oh, he says it should be a pleasant fatigue. A culmination of an assigned task well done.
So says your Mr. Roodles.
Yes.
Oh, dear. Yeah, I'd like to meet him.
Now could we come in and see Rosenberg and Flanagan?
Certainly. Just a moment and I will announce you. You are Mr. A.B.'s father... And you're Rosemary's father?
Yes. How did you know that?
Oh, Mr. Abey told me all about you.
Then why did you hand us that line?
Mr. Riddles, I don't make the rules, but I do my best to keep them.
Yeah, you're cute. Fancy Pep.
And France is as pretty as the map of Ireland.
Oh, but I'm not Irish, Mr. Murphy. I'm Russian. That is Russian descent.
And you look it. Just like I do. Don't she, Pep?
Well, no, she may be Russian and look it, but her face is certainly prettier than your map. And that's no lie.
Oh, well, gentlemen, when you wrote for your appointment...
But, we didn't write.
Well, it's just for my records, you know. Did you use your letterhead?
Oh, for the records. Well, if we didn't, we certainly will the next time.
It isn't one of the old hickory singers, Kitty.
It was the Linnet Bathtub Review, if I remember correctly, when he first started on CBS. I did not go on with Fred on that show. Now, I had been doing a character called Blubber Bergman. Something like this. Not unlike the Joe Palooka, which I had done on the air years before. I was thrown out of a job by Fred coming on and taking over that time. And Fred, from that show on, was really starting to build. They didn't know. They didn't really know with the first one whether it was going to make it or not. But once they got set there, it started to build and never went down again, and then only up. But strangely enough, it was written, and Fred's wit was so creative and so new that many of the things were above the level of acceptance by a large portion of the audience, and Fred never got the rating that Jack Benny, for instance, had. Although to a great number of people, and to me, Fred was the top creative wit of all time in radio. Every word, the final wordage of every one of Fred Allen's programs was his own. He had many writers and many very, very top talented writers. Nat Hiken, who later on wrote and created the Sergeant Bilko thing that Phil Silvers did. Herman Wouk, who went on to become a great novelist, all started. A great number of good, talented writers were writing for Fred. But Fred's great talent was in making everything fit him. The final wordage gave him a distinction that was a Fred Allen feel to the whole thing. And I think he was just magnificent, not only as a creative writer and wit, but as one of the warmest and nicest human beings that I ever came in contact with. This was a wonderful, wonderful association that I finally
had. How about it, Fred?
Say, if you don't know, laughing at your next Sunday show already.
I'd give $1,000 if I could think of an answer right now.
If you don't know by now that I don't want that car, you ought to have your skull thinned.
All right, Fred, as long as you don't want to buy it, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll wrap it in cellophane, tie a big red ribbon around it, and give it to you for Christmas. How's that?
If I wake up Christmas morning and find that monstrosity in my stocking, I'll go barefooted the rest of my life.
That would be nothing new for you, you hillbilly. So you don't even want it for a present, huh?
I don't want it present, past, or future. You can take that animated skillet...
All right, Fred, all right. I merely wanted to be a good fellow, that's all. If you don't want the car, and I think you don't, I'll be on my way. No hard feelings, I hope.
No, Jack, I haven't anything against you, not Benny the man. I'm just not in the market, that's all. I hope I didn't offend you.
Oh, no, Freddy, I'll just have to sell it to some other guy. Christmas, old boy.
Same to you, Jack, and good luck.
Thanks, Freddy. Goodbye.
Hey, what was that, Jack?
That's what my car thinks of you, Alan.
Occasionally, if something presented itself, yes, he would ad-lib. But not to the extent. Many things which seemed like an ad-lib were made ready. You know, because you had to be ready. Occasionally, there's an ad-lib. I ad-libbed once in rhyme as Falstaff. I started to do one of my titles, and my voice clogged up. And I don't know where it came, but it came to me out of the blue, and I said, "Pardon, friends, a discordant note. Falstaff's found a frog in throat." And oh boy, this was something. But speaking of ad-libs, Jack Benny and Fred Allen, you remember there was a rivalry between them. It was a phony feud. They loved each other, of course. They made a picture together, and it was to open at the Paramount Theater in New York, and they were to meet on radio coverage of the picture from the lobby of the Paramount Theater. And we were rehearsing the morning this noontime thing was supposed to take place with Jack and Fred. And Nat Hiken, who was writing on the show then, said, "You think I ought to write you a few ad-libs, or you ought to get a few ad-libs ready in case Benny starts to ad-lib?" And Fred said, "Benny," he said, "he couldn't ad-lib a burp after a Hungarian dinner."
Ah, it's good to get back to Allen's Alley, Portland. Well, I guess the senator's just finished dinner. There's a big catfish head on the lawn. See the flies? Well, let's knock.
Somebody knock. Hey, somebody knock.
Yes, I'm
here. Claghorn's the name. Senator Claghorn, that is.
You're from the South.
When I play bridge, I'm never sitting off.
Now, wait a minute.
This man who knows Senator's best, it's Claghorn 6 7/8 to 3.
Now, look.
Senator. I shot a robin this morning.
You shot a robin?
I caught the little feathered traitor flying back from the South.
Oh. Well, tell me, Senator, what is the reaction to this poultry surplus down there in Washington?
Every time, every time I mention chickens, Senator Hatch eggs me on.
Oh,
ah!
Yeah.
Hatch, hey,
Craig,
that's a jest, son. Hey, own up, son. You're just a dumb doodle. You're extinct, that is.
Now, wait a minute.
Let me get in here. Tell me, Senator, are you doing, personally, are you doing anything about this chicken surplus?
I'm eating chicken every day.
Good.
I have my own recipe, chicken a la Claghorn.
Chicken a la Claghorn. How do you prepare your fowl, Senator?
First, I soak my chicken overnight in Kentucky bourbon.
Uh-huh.
Hard for me to go on here now. Then I boil it in Louisiana corn.
Yeah.
Baste it with Mississippi mint julep.
Yes.
Then I'll leave it in the skillet over a slow fire for 2 days.
And the chicken's ready?
I don't bother with the chicken.
No.
When I get through lapping up that gravy,
yes,
I'm southern fried. So long.
Well, the senator certainly knows his culinary stuff. Well, let's see if Mr. Moody is here.
Howdy, Bob.
You look a little tired, Mr. Moody.
Yeah, I had set up all night in the pig pen.
Oh, really?
One of my pigs had ptomaine.
Oh. Well, how could a pig get ptomaine?
I don't know. Must have had a piece of tainted swill or something.
Oh, is something wrong?
Yeah, I got the rheumatism in both arms. Just got it quick.
Oh, that's too bad. Well, doesn't the rheumatism bother you working?
Just milking. I can't move my arms.
Well, how do you milk?
Well, first I sit on the stool.
Yes.
I get a good grip.
I see.
Then I just hold on.
And?
The cow jumps up and down.
Tell me, Mr. Moody, what about this chicken surplus?
Oh, there's only one way to stop a chicken surplus. Nip it in the nest.
Nip it in the nest? You mean...
Stop the hens from setting, from having more chickens.
Well, how?
See what I done last week.
What?
Well, I put a dozen China eggs in one nest.
China eggs? And what happened?
That hen hatched out the prettiest set of demi-tassie cups I ever seen. So long, man.
I've never heard of a hen and her cups before. Oh, well, let's try this next door.
No.
Not Mrs. Nussbaum.
You are expecting maybe Ronald Goldman.
Tell me, Mrs. Nussbaum, are you doing your bit to help reduce the chicken surplus?
I'm sending to Washington a slogan.
Oh, what is your slogan?
The war is over. We're through with bullets. Now is the time. Start cooking pullets.
Very good. Excellent. Are you, beside the slogan, are you using poultry at home?
For every meal in my house, I'm serving chicken.
No kidding.
For breakfast, I'm making Wheaties.
Uh-huh.
Concealed in the Wheaties is chicken gizzard.
Chicken gizzard. You have coffee, too?
Oh, instead of coffee, I'm serving piping hot a cup of chicken fat.
Oh, yum, yum.
For lunch, I'm cooking chicken Chinese style.
Chinese chicken?
This is egg foo young.
Uh-huh.
Instead of the foo, I'm putting in chicken giblets.
Oh, instead of the foo. Well, that should improve the taste. And you serve it Chinese style with chopsticks?
No, with drumsticks.
Oh, with drumsticks. What is for dinner?
Roast chicken stuffed.
Stuffed, huh?
Inside the roast chicken is a boiled chicken.
Oh.
After dinner is coming chicken coffee.
Well, what is chicken coffee?
Instead of sugar,
uh-huh,
in the coffee I'm dropping 2 lumps of white meat.
Well, chicken 3 times a day, isn't your husband complaining?
Complaining? Pierre is wanting even more chicken.
Well, how do you know?
Yesterday, I'm catching him with 2 guan.
Oh. Here we are at the end of Allen's Alley. What can happen at this last shanty?
Hi-ho, all. It isn't Rudy Valley. It's the poet laureate of Allen's Alley.
You have new poems for us tonight.
Oh, indubitably. Have you heard, said Mayor O'Dwyer to Mr. Quill, surprise, the subways are running still?
No.
Or, life, said the worm, didn't give me a break. If I was 3 feet longer, I'd be a snake.
No.
Mother's spirits are low. They've almost hit bottom. She knows Gable is back and Gotham has got it.
No! This is the straw that sent the camel to the osteopath. Tonight we are discussing the chicken surplus.
I know. I have prepared a poem.
And what is your chicken surplus quatrain called?
In rebuttal.
In rebuttal. How does it go?
The rooster flew to the henhouse roof and crowed to the world at large his message conceived in rebuttal to the chicken surplus charge. We give up our lives, crowed the rooster, and I speak for each chicken and hen who has died and been fried through the ages to grace the tables of men. Today you proclaim there's a surplus, yet to death you continue to doom us. Your cold storage warehouses glutted with fowl and none to consume us. The real reason there's a surplus of poultry is the population has shrunk in New York. So don't go around blaming us chickens. Go take it up with the stalk.
Thank you, Falstaff. And now from foul Calderola Falstaff, return with pleasure to the Chickory Chick Choir, the five DeMarco sisters, accompanied by Maestro Al Goodman and his surplus symphonist. The DeMarco sing Atlanta, G.A.
There was no Allen's Alley until Falstaff started. And what happened was, Fred had had a neighbor called Openshaw in Maine. He was a carpenter up there. And he had a lot of crazy sounding names on Town Hall tonight. He'd interview people, you know. And he called this guy Falstaff Openshaw, and it was during a summer period when the summer theaters were blossoming all over the country in barns and haylofts and all kinds of things. And he interviewed this character, who I did as a ham actor, you know. And at the end, he had a parody on a popular poem. And it was written by Vic Knight, who was then writing for Town Hall and producing the show, directing it. It got an enormous amount of letters. Fred had never repeated a character, never had started to build and have regular appearances by a character. So Vic persuaded him to try another poem because the requests that came in were for the poem, you see, and they liked the character. After the second week, still on Town Hall tonight, more came in, and more mail. And after the third week, there was a regular avalanche, and by then, Falstaff was launched as a character. Fred couldn't get rid of him. He could have, I suppose, by saying it, but he got a lot of mail, because it was a highlight people were then looking forward to. And Allen's Alley would always have a theme. He'd ask the same kind of question of each member of the alley. And then Falstaff would finish with a poem, usually about eight lines, that fit the topic under discussion. And it was normally something in the news, something hot.
It's so good to get back to Allen's Alley, Portland. It's as quiet as an eel coiling in a bucket of whipped cream. Say, I wonder if the senator is in. Let's knock.
Somebody, I say, somebody knock.
Yes,
Claghorn's your name, Senator Claghorn.
Well,
that
now,
is.
Look, I know.
Something tells me you don't remember me, son.
Look, I remember
I'm
you.
I'm from the South. The Poon and Possum Paradise.
Now, look, Senator.
The only plant life I have around my house is a Virginia creeper.
Now, wait a minute.
Every time I get chicken pox, they're southern fried.
Senator.
Remember me now, son?
No.
Don't say no in my presence.
Why not?
N-O, that's North abbreviated.
Wait a minute, Senator. What about this sleeping problem?
When I first went to the Senate, I had plenty of trouble sleeping. After the roll was called, I'd put on my sail sucker nightshirt and my Lindsay Woolsey beret.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd face the south, lean back, close my eyes.
And go to sleep, eh?
Until some Yankee pigeon plucker would get up, start flapping his lips, and break up my Morpheus filibuster. enough of that here.
Heard you the first time, Senator. Are you still losing sleep, Senator?
No, I've solved my problem, son.
How?
When I'm ready to sleep in the Senate, I'll sit back and croon myself my southern lullaby.
What is your southern lullaby?
Rock-a-bye, small fry on the cotton tree top. When the southern wind blows, your cradle will rock. When the wind's from the north, I say, baby, you'll bawl. For down will come cradle, tree, and you all.
Well, very good, Senator. So long, so long, so long. Well, the Senator stopped just in time. I was dozing off myself. Now, I wonder how Titus Moody is doing.
Howdy, bud.
To sound like Dennis Day, Titus. Johnny, Mr. Moody. Do you have any trouble sleeping?
I only half sleep.
Half sleep?
I got short eyelids.
With short eyelids, you can't close your eyes, eh?
Only when I frown.
Oh, I see. Well, are you the only one awake on the farm?
No, daylight saving time has got everything in a swivet.
The animals are bewildered?
Yeah, my cow had insomnia.
Your cow didn't sleep at all?
The bags under her eyes were so big, I didn't know which end to milk.
You were confused, eh?
Yeah. First time I milked the wrong end and got two buckets full of homogenized tears.
Well, have you cured the cow's insomnia?
I got a book on hypnotizing.
Good.
I stood in front of the cow.
Yeah?
I stared right into her eyes.
Uh-huh.
I started waving with my hand.
Uh-huh.
I said, Alagazam, Alagazan, you ain't a cow, you're a hen.
You're a hen. Well, was your hypnotism a success?
Yeah. Today, that cow thinks she's a hen.
Well, how do you know?
Well, she's sitting on a nest.
You mean?
She's laying eggnogs. Come on, man.
Let's try this next door here.
No.
Oh, Mrs. Nussbaum.
You were expecting maybe Hoagy Carbuncle.
Tell me, Mrs. Ann, do you have trouble sleeping?
Who could sleep? Every night with his dreaming, my husband Pierre is waking me up.
He dreams, huh?
Always he has different things.
Dreams he's different things? How do you mean?
One night, Pierre is dreaming he is the lone stranger.
Yeah.
All night long, he is yelling, hi-ho, Silver!
Hi-ho, Silver, huh?
Upstairs is living a Mrs. Silver.
Yeah.
He is yelling back, hi-ho, Nussbaum.
I see.
One night, Pierre is dreaming he is an automobile, a roadster.
A roadster?
In his pajamas, Pierre is sleeping with the top down.
Oh. Fine.
Once, he is dreaming he is an Alka-Seltzer.
An Alka-Seltzer?
All night, Pierre is fizzing.
Well, no wonder. No wonder you can't sleep.
Last night, he should drop dead.
What happened?
He is dreaming he is a tea kettle.
A tea kettle, huh?
All night long, Pierre is whistling.
Whistling?
In the morning when he is waking.
Yeah?
In bed with Pierre is 20 dogs.
Well, that brings us to the lavender shanty at the end of the alley. Let's try here.
You knocked three times. Do you think that's nice? In my last picture, the postman rang twice.
Ah, Falstaff, you have new poems tonight?
Indubitably. Hast heard, said the little bear to the big giraffe, let's see the hyena just for a laugh?
No.
Or when I called her baby, her face lit up because she had a lantern jaw?
No.
How about this? Mother's home putting spikes in her shoes. She's playing first base for Vera Cruz.
Now, wait a minute, Paul. You exponent of the Hackney, tonight we are discussing the problem of sleep.
My poem awaits your bidding.
And what is your shut-eye sonata called?
My recipe for slumber.
How does it be?
If you cannot sleep at night and you don't know what to do, my recipe for slumber is just the thing for you. Don't waste time taking powders. Don't bother counting sheep. Don't dawdle in a hot bath hoping you will sleep. But don't give up drinking coffee. Don't send for any gland man.
You can eat and drink all night, and still you'll meet the Sandman. My recipe for slumber is older than the Sphinx. Just cut 20 tiddlies into halves, and you'll get 40 winks.
Well, thank you. And the Falstaff runs for cover. We turn to greet the DeMarco sisters. Accompanied by Maestro Al Goodman, and as I haven't got a joke for them this week, Philharmonic, the DeMarco sing Doing What Comes Naturally.
There were days I remember on independent stations in New York, WMCA, WOR, which was part of a so-called network, but wasn't really a network, WHN, which was the Lowe's State Theater building and was an MGM-owned station. The city of New York had a station, WNYC, in which Fiorello LaGuardia, when he was mayor, used to read the funny papers to the kids every Sunday morning. A lot of very fine programming began on these local stations that were later picked up on the networks. I remember in the early days, it was not an uncommon thing for the last few pages of a story show, a situation show, to be handed to us handwritten while we were on the air. The shows weren't finished, and a guy would come running in the studio and give you the last two pages, and you had to figure out his hieroglyphics and ad-lib through it. They were hectic times. It was a new medium, and people were feeling their way and trying things.
Yabba-dabba-doo.
That phrase has come to mean quite a bit to me. You know, it's from the Flintstones, and it's Fred's expression to express exuberance, excitement, or things like that that happen. I had auditioned for the part, along with everybody else in the field, and I didn't get it in the beginning. I had made the point with Joe Barbera, who was producing, that for the first time, they were doing a half-hour show that was going on in prime time in television. And that instead of a cartoon voice, which they seemed to be looking for, they should have a great legitimacy to this guy. He should be a very real person that the audience would be able to identify with. And Joe and Bill had been heads of cartooning at MGM. They had done the Tom and Jerry cartoons before they started with this. And they'd been very successful with the cartoon voice of Dawes Butler doing Huckleberry Hound and Yogi Bear. And this was a different thing. They were dealing not with animals, but with humans. And I made this strong point, and I played him as he is being played now. But they decided to go ahead with somebody else, and they made four shows. And then realized that what I had said was so, and they threw out the four shows and brought Mel Blanc and in with me, and we've been doing it ever since.
Oh, Fred, you're the greatest.
Hey, how about inviting everyone over for coffee?
Oh, wonderful. I'll go invite them.
I'll get the car. Boy, what a wonderful evening this has been. I met a lot of new friends tonight, and I gave my old ones a good laugh. Thanks to you.
It was a time of feeling and beginning and developing techniques and really some wonderful experiments came out. Stage one, the experimental theater of the air, created what Playhouse 90, for instance, in television created. Great drama, good writers developing, and so on. Radio had come to a place where I believe it made a tremendous contribution to learning in all spheres, because the work became more and more inclusive of living patterns and things that were truths that a lot of people didn't realize they were pointed out. It was a time of growing wings. Now I'm 64, and this is my 50th year in the entertainment industry.
Reminiscing, I feel you near. Once more, you're my love of yesteryear.
With us next week for another nostalgic look at radio of yesteryear.
And now it's just about time we were picking up our memories and moving along our way. I hope you've enjoyed listening to these songs and the memories that go with them as much as I've enjoyed bringing them to you. And I'll be keeping my weather eye peeled. Yes, sir. Looking for you all to join us the next time we drop around this way for a friendly little get-together. And I hope that'll be real soon, folks. And until then, this is your old friend Singing Sam saying goodbye for now.
Same time, same station, is produced for KRLA News by John Price. Associate producer, Cam Currier. Special research by Martin Halperin. Our thanks to Alan Reed for sharing his radio memoirs with us tonight.
Be sure to be with us next week at this same time